Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Mark J. Braunstein, MD, PhD, to discuss some of the most noteworthy data in multiple myeloma that were presented during the 2020 ASCO Virtual Scientific Program. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Braunstein, assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at NYU Long Island School of Medicine, course co-director of the Hematology Oncology System, and co-director of the Autologous Stem Cell Transplant Program at NYU Winthrop Hospital of NYU Langone Health's Perlmutter Cancer Center, provided perspective on data in the upfront and relapsed refractory settings regarding the use of triplet and quadruplet regimens, novel agents, and cellular therapies. Let's start with upfront treatment for multiple myeloma. What data were presented from the Phase 3 Endurance trial?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's my privilege to review some of the abstracts from ASCO this year. And at a virtual ASCO, we had a strong showing of 9 oral abstracts and 1 plenary. And this study that you mentioned was actually a late-breaking abstract that was presented at the plenary session, which is like the top abstracts at ASCO. And the Phase 3 Endurance study has been a long time coming because in the field, we were very eager to see the head-to-head comparison up front, a triplet regimen that includes either the proteasome inhibitor bortezomib or the proteasome inhibitor carfilzomib in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, because these are the two most common upfront regimens we've been using. And as a background, the Phase 3 Endeavor study, which was published in Lancet Oncology in 2016, showed superiority of carfilzomib dexamethasone compared to bortezomib dexamethasone in the relapse refractory setting. However, this has not been shown in the first line setting to date. And in fact, there was a recent Phase 3 Clarion study published in Blood in 2019 that failed to show superiority of carfilzomib versus bortezomib when each was combined with melphalan and prednisone in transplant-ineligible newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. So the Phase 3 Endurance study that was presented at virtual ASCO was a Phase 3 study comparing KRD versus BRD in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients who were not planned to go to stem cell transplant. And the primary outcome was progression-free survival. So there was an impressive enrollment of 1,087 patients. About half went to the bortezomib-containing BRD arm and half to the carfilzomib-containing KRD arm with a median age of 65. They were all newly diagnosed. Importantly, we should note that these investigators excluded patients with high-risk cytogenetics, which tend to be about 15 to 20% of our standard patients presenting with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. And so the interventions included one arm getting the BRD regimen for up to 12 cycles, while the KRD arm received up to 9 cycles. And these both were followed by maintenance lenalidomide, initially randomized for 2 years, but also amended to include up to progression of disease. So the main finding of the study was that there was no statistical difference between the two arms, both achieving a median progression-free survival of around 34 months. And there are no differences based on age above or below 65 or stage. And the 3-year overall survival was also very similar at about 85% in both arms. So those were the main findings of the primary outcome, but there were some differences that were important that are important to note, particularly the side effect profile. In terms of adverse events, there was a significantly higher rate of cardiovascular and renal toxicities noted with the carfilzomib-containing arm, about 16 versus 5% in the bortezomib-containing arm, while in the VRD bortezomib-containing arm, the rates of neuropathy were higher at about 8 percent versus 1%. And these are consistent with the known differential toxicity profiles of bortezomib compared to carfilzomib. One of the criticisms of the study was that, for one thing, it didn't include high-risk multiple myeloma patients who, in prior studies of carfilzomib, seemed to have a benefit. There were a different number of cycles of treatment between each arm. And of note, about 27% of patients in each group actually did go on to autologous stem cell transplant, which was not planned according to the design of the study. So I think the conclusion from this very important study that we've been waiting for is that there really wasn't a difference in terms of efficacy between the VRD versus KRD. And I think enthusiasts who favor bortezomib will be satisfied, and those who favor carfilzomib will be satisfied, and the ones that favor carfilzomib will say that you can avoid the higher rates of neuropathy by giving the KRD regimen, and those who favor bortezomib will say you can avoid the higher rates of cardiac and renal toxicity. So I think either regimen is a reasonable first-line regimen for newly diagnosed myeloma patients, in this case who were not high risk. It was an important study presented by Shaji Kumar on behalf of ECOG.
Moving to the phase 2 GMMG concepts trial, could you discuss those data regarding the quadruplet regimen of isatuximab, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone?
Yeah, so this was an oral session presented by Dr. Weisel on behalf of the German Multiple Myeloma Group. This was an interim analysis of a phase 2 study that was investigator-initiated called the GMMG concept trial, evaluating now a quadruplet regimen, which is kind of the trend that we're pursuing these days in terms of upfront treatment, in terms of combining a monoclonal antibody with a triplet regimen to create a quadruplet regimen. And in this case, the monoclonal antibody was isatuximab, which is a monoclonal antibody that works by various mechanisms to target CD38 and destroy multiple myeloma plasma cells. And in this case, they combined isatuximab with carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, so that's the ISA-KRD, and actually focused the study on high-risk, newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients. Now, as a background, the prognosis for high-risk multiple myeloma patients is less than their standard risk counterparts. And this has been a longstanding challenge that still remains an area of need in terms of therapeutics. Isatuximab is an intravenous anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody that was recently approved in combination with pomalidomide and dexamethasone in relapse refractory myeloma based on the phase 3 ICARIA-MM study published by Atal and colleagues in The Lancet 2019. And that showed a 40% reduction in the risk of progression in relapse refractory multiple myeloma. The concept trial that was presented at ASCO is a phase 2 study that actually contained both transplant eligible and ineligible patients, the majority being eligible. And this was the interim analysis of 153 patients planned to enroll. This was the interim of 50 high-risk multiple myeloma patients. And the median age was 58. And high-risk multiple myeloma was defined by the standard categories, including deletion of 17p, translocation 414 or 1416, or greater than 3 copies of 1q21, and stage 2 or 3 disease by the International Staging System. And 4 cycles of ISA-KRD consolidation, followed by ISA-KR maintenance. There were 2 arms that either included patients who were transplant eligible or patients that were transplant ineligible, and they were both kind of presented in the oral session. So the main finding of the study, impressively, was that there was a 100% overall response rate. And this included 46% of patients who achieved a stringent complete remission and 90% of patients who achieved a VGPR or better. The study also looked at minimal residual disease status by flow cytometry, and 20% achieved MRD negativity in the transplant arm of the study. Of note, there was no impact of this quadruplet regimen on stem cell collection, though some patients needed additional agents to allow for stem cell harvest and mobilization. in terms of adverse events, they were mostly anticipated. Primarily hematologic adverse events were encountered, such as leukopenia. And there were less than 20% hematologic grade 3 or higher adverse events. So I think this is, again, an important regimen that is in line with the benefit of adding monoclonal antibodies to upfront therapy. For example, the phase 2 master trial presented at ASH 2019 showed that there was a higher rate of MRD negativity when you combine the other available anti-CD38 antibody, daratumumab, along with KRD. So I think quadruplet regimens can induce high response rates and rates of MRD negativity. And what was impactful about the CONCEPT trial is that it showed that we can actually induce those rates in high-risk multiple myeloma patients with the quadruplet regimen of ESA-KRD. And the overall safety profile is consistent with previous reports. So phase 2 and 3 studies remain ongoing, and I think this will eventually become another regimen in our armamentarium for first-line patients, particularly who are high-risk.
What is your take-home message for newly diagnosed disease, and how do you see these data impacting the space?
So it's a really important question, and fortunately, we're well-positioned to answer it with many options. Now we have doublet, triplet, and quadruplet upfront regimens, and I think it always goes back to tailoring those regimens to the individual multiple myeloma patient. That includes an assessment of their degree of frailty, their comorbidities, the goals of the therapy, their cytogenetic risk, and whether or not they may be eligible for consolidation with autologous stem cell transplant. And clearly, the more agents you combine synergistically to target multiple myeloma plasma cell clones, the deeper response rates you can achieve, and that pretty consistently correlates with long-term remissions. I think we're heading to a place where we can start to think about how we can actually overcome clonal resistance to the point where we can potentially cure patients with a combination of intensive induction regimens, autologous stem cell transplant, and then additional therapies that might be additional cellular therapies, such as CAR T cell therapies, or some other form of highly effective maintenance therapy in order to allow for the longest remission. So I don't think there's a consensus on whether patients who are most fit should get triplet versus quadruplet regimens, but clearly quadruplet regimens are revealing themselves to be highly effective at prolonging remissions and allowing for the highest degree of MRD negativity. So I think we're going to see more data come out with the other monoclonal antibodies, including the ones targeting SLAMF7 and BCMA for use in upfront therapy. And then we'll have many options to allow ourselves to tailor therapy to newly diagnosed patients.
Moving to the relapse refractory paradigm, what was found in the phase 1-2 DREAM-6 study and the BVD regimen?
As we've been seeing in the first line setting where we have multiple options, there's just been an explosion of therapies for not just relapse refractory patients who have progressed after their first line of therapy, but patients who have progressed after multiple lines of therapies, 6, 7, even some studies, 14 different types of regimens. So, we appreciate in the field that clonal resistance is really what leads to shorter remissions over time. And so now that we have more therapies to offer patients who are relapse refractory, we're beginning to see more combinations in that setting. So the DREAM-6 study looked at the combination of belantamab mafodotin in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone in relapse refractory multiple myeloma. This was presented by Dr. Nuka from Emory. And this was a phase 1-2 study looking at safety and tolerability. Now, as a background, belantamab itself is a monoclonal antibody targeting the B-cell maturation antigen, or BCMA, which is highly expressed on multiple myeloma plasma cells. And belantamab mafodotin is a first-in-class antibody-drug conjugate that has a BCMA-targeting monoclonal antibody combined with a mafodotin, which inhibits microtubule activity and leads to cell death. And so as a background, the phase two DREAM study looked at single agent belantamab mafodotin in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma and showed a 35% overall response rate in highly refractory patients with a median overall survival of 14 months. The current study, the DREAM 6 study, is a phase 1-2 study of patients with relapsed refractory multiple myeloma progressing beyond with one or more prior therapies. And they looked at the combination of belantamab with bortezomib and dexamethasone with the primary outcome, again, of safety and tolerability, as well as overall response rate. The authors presented data from 18 relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, either with a prior stem cell transplant or those who were ineligible and had been treated with one or more prior lines of therapy. In fact, 22% of the patients were treated with more than 7 lines of prior therapy, which would make them very resistant to standard agents that are available in the setting. And the majority of the patients received the 2.5 milligram per kilogram single dose of belantamab every 3 weeks, along with the standard dosing of bortezomib and dexamethasone. The median age was 67, and 33% of patients were high risk. And the median time on therapy at the time of presentation was 18 months. So the main findings of the study was that the overall response rate was 78%, which is impressive in the setting of refractory disease, with a 50% very good partial remission or better. In terms of adverse events, there was a high rate of adverse events, though they did not lead to treatment discontinuations and were mostly manageable. So the adverse event rate was 100%, but there were no fatal adverse events. There seems to be a unique safety profile of belantamab in that 83% of patients had corneal events, including blurry vision, dry eyes, or keratopathy, that would need to be most likely co-managed with an ophthalmologist. And 39% of patients had thrombocytopenia. Those were the two most frequently reported adverse events and were clinically manageable. So I think the conclusion to the study is that I think belantamab mafodotin offers a unique therapeutic approach that's very much needed in refractory multiple myeloma. So that's the overview of this DREAM 6 study.
Now, of course, the role of selinexor is an area of much discussion currently. So how have the findings from the Boston study impacted the agent's role in the relapse refractory space of multiple myeloma?
And the phase 3 Boston study was one of the highlights, I think, at virtual ASCO this year. This was presented by Dr. Dimopoulos from Greece, and in an oral session. And as a background to the study, you know, selinexor is basically a first-in-class oral selective inhibitor of exportin-1, which blocks the export of tumor suppressors from the nucleus and leads to inhibiting multiple myeloma growth. Selinexor was approved in combination with dexamethasone based on the phase 2 STORM study published by Chari and colleagues in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, showing a 26% overall response rate in triple class and in some instances penta-refractory multiple myeloma. And this was really the first agent that was really studied and approved in patients who had progressed even past monoclonal antibody therapies in the relapse refractory setting. So the Boston study presented at ASCO is a phase 3 study of weekly selinexor, bortezomib, and dexamethasone compared to twice weekly bortezomib dexamethasone in patients with multiple myeloma refractory to one to three prior therapies. So it's a triplet regimen versus a doublet, and the primary outcome was progression-free survival. 402 relapse refractory multiple myeloma patients with one to three prior therapies and at least a partial remission to a prior proteasome inhibitor therapy were enrolled. Of note, the patients had to have a creatinine clearance of 20 or better and an absolute neutrophil count greater than 1,000 and a platelet count greater than 75,000. And that is similar to how selinexor was approved, because the drug can lower blood counts and patients need to have a certain threshold when starting. So 195 patients were randomized to the SVD arm and 207 to the VD doublet arm. The median age was 67. And the baseline characteristics were well-balanced across the two arms. About 50% of patients in each arm were high risk, and about 80% had prior exposure to a proteasome inhibitor, either bortezomib or carfilzomib. But also of note, relatively few, only about 3 to 6% in each arm, had prior exposure to daratumumab, which targets CD38. So in terms of the methods, crossover was allowed from the VD to the SVD arm, provided the patients had no intolerance to bortezomib in the VD arm. And the main finding was that the SVD arm showed significantly prolonged progression-free survival with a median of 13.9 versus 9.5 months and a 30% reduction in progression by adding selinexor. Also, the overall response rate with the triplet was 76% versus 62% in the doublet arm, which was significantly better. The median overall survival was not reached in the SVD arm and was 25 months in the VD arm, though that was not significantly different, but I think it needs to be read out further. Importantly, in the subgroup analysis, there was a progression-free survival benefit across high-risk patients, and the median duration of response was 23 months in the selinexor arm versus 13 months in the doublet. Now, in terms of adverse events, I think they were consistent with the known toxicity profile of selinexor, including a higher rate of nausea, about 8% versus 0% in the doublet arm. Fatigue, thrombocytopenia were more common with selinexor, though manageable. And actually, peripheral neuropathy rates, grade 2 or higher, were lower with SVD compared to VD. And I think the reason for that is that the SVD arm had once weekly dosing compared to twice weekly dosing in the control arm with bortezomib. So there's an ongoing study of selinexor, carfilzomib, dexamethasone in relapsed refractory, as well as combinations like this in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. So I think selinexor is an important novel agent in our arsenal to treat highly refractory multiple myeloma. And I think when you combine it in a triplet regimen, you may actually see less toxicity and more efficacy and more tolerability. So I think it's going to be interesting to see the results of additional studies that are ongoing looking at selinexor in combination with several other agents, including monoclonal antibodies.
What would you say is your take-home message regarding how these data may impact the relapsed refractory space?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we're making tremendous progress in the relapse refractory setting because this is really a challenging group of patients, particularly those who have progressed and are refractory to multiple classes of agents. And so I think these novel approaches targeting exportin-1 with selinexor or BCMA through various mechanisms, including the use of CAR T cell therapy, I think we're making tremendous progress in this area. Again, I think that we're at a point where we have many therapies, but still need to think about how to best sequence these therapies and what markers we can use based on the biology of malignant plasma cells in order to guide and match the best therapy to the individual patient and tailor that treatment. Nevertheless, I think we have a lot of agents that are coming down the pipeline and combinations for multiple myeloma, and I'm hoping that not only are these combinations efficacious, but perhaps can overcome resistance in patients who have become resistant to other classes of approved agents for myeloma when they're combined with these novel therapies. So I think the future is bright for the field of multiple myeloma, and we're making a lot of progress both in the newly diagnosed and relapse refractory setting with novel agents.
How has the role of transplant been impacted by findings from the STAMINA study presented at this year's ASCO?
Autologous stem cell transplant has been a mainstay of multiple myeloma really since the 1980s. And there have been a plethora of studies showing the efficacy of autologous stem cell transplant, with even recently randomized data showing a benefit in patients who were transplant eligible in the IFM 2009 study, who were randomized to either transplant or just induction therapy and consolidation alone. And we saw a progression-free survival benefit in a transplant arm in that study. So I think that autologous stem cell transplant remains a mainstay of multiple myeloma therapy for those that are eligible. But the STAMINA study was a very interesting study that helped give us more insight into the role of maintenance therapy following stem cell transplant, consolidation after transplant, or whether there's any benefit of doing a tandem transplant, which is where you do a second autologous stem cell transplant shortly after the first one in an attempt to additionally suppress and consolidate multiple myeloma residual disease. So the STAMINA trial was actually published by Stadmauer in Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2019. This abstract presented at ASCO was a long-term six-year follow-up of the study. So as a background, the study was designed as follows. It was a phase 3 trial where of 750 newly diagnosed transplant-eligible multiple myeloma patients, and they were treated with a basically dealer's choice of induction therapy, and then consolidated with high-dose melphalan and autologous stem cell transplant. After that, they were randomized to one of three arms. One was lenalidomide maintenance alone. Two was four additional cycles of consolidation with the standard VRD, bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone triplet, or a tandem second high-dose melphalan autologous stem cell transplant. All of the arms included lenalidomide maintenance. And so the original, the STAMINA study that was published in JCO, basically the conclusion was that there was no difference between the three arms in terms of the primary outcome, which was progression-free survival. What the six-year follow-up presented at ASCO helped clarify was the benefit of continuing lenalidomide maintenance indefinitely versus stopping after 3 years. And so, again, there were about 750 patients in this study. All the patients were less than age 70 and transplant eligible. They were diagnosed with multiple myeloma according to the criteria before the revision by the IMWG in 2014. And again, they had at least two cycles of induction therapy followed by transplant and then randomized to one of the three arms. And the majority of patients went on to the randomization and maintenance phases. So again, there was no difference in progression-free or overall survival at 38 months. The curves between the maintenance arm, the consolidation arm, and the tandem transplant arm essentially overlapped. Also of note, there was no progression in patients who completed the 3 years of maintenance lenalidomide. However, what is important to note and what the transplanters often argue is that when you look at the subgroup of high-risk patients at 5 years, the progression-free survival did show a significant benefit in the tandem auto-auto arm compared to the consolidation or maintenance arm alone. So that group of high-risk patients with tandem transplant showed a 44% progression-free survival at 5 years, which was significantly better compared to the other two arms. So there may be a benefit for tandem transplant in high-risk multiple myeloma patients. In terms of looking at maintenance lenalidomide beyond 3 years, there was a benefit of progression-free survival benefit of continuous lenalidomide maintenance, although this did not necessarily hold true for high-risk patients. There was no difference, but there was a progression-free survival benefit of continuous lenalidomide maintenance in the range of 80% at 6 years, compared to 61% in patients who stopped lenalidomide maintenance after 3 years. Of note, when we give lenalidomide, one of the concerns is the risk of secondary malignancies, though there was no statistical difference in this study in terms of secondary malignancies between the arms. So I think the conclusion here is that it shows that, first of all, it was an important study done with a cooperative group, and it shows that you can really achieve some very important data using a cooperative group studies. There is no difference in progression-free survival, whether you do one transplant or tandem, or go on to maintenance without consolidation, though for high-risk patients, they may benefit from a tandem autologous stem cell transplant. And all patients should definitely be maintained on some form of maintenance, in this case, lenalidomide, probably until progression.
Now, of course, cellular therapies are an area of a lot of excitement across multiple tumor types. So moving to CAR T-cell therapy, could you discuss findings from the CARTITUDE 1 and CARMA studies evaluating CAR T-cell therapy in multiple myeloma?
Chimeric antigen receptor T-cells were first developed in lymphomas and leukemias, but we're seeing some very exciting results in multiple myeloma. And there are three major products moving forward, all of which were presented at ASCO, and all of which are targeting the BCMA antigen. And all of these studies are looking at late-stage multiple myeloma. Many of these studies had included a sizable portion of patients with high-risk multiple myeloma. And the response rates that we're seeing from these studies are really unprecedented in this class of patients. Well, the three studies that were presented were the CARMA, Evolve, and the CARTITUDE study. The CARMA and Evolve study are looking at BMS CAR T-cell products that target BCMA, and the CARTITUDE is the Janssen product that also targets BCMA. You know, what's interesting is that the safety profile for these products is fairly similar in terms of the rates of cytokine release syndrome, which is a known side effect of CAR T-cells, although the efficacy differed somewhat. And I think the one that I'll focus on is the CARTITUDE 1 study, which was presented as an update of the phase 1b2 study of the J&J 4528 CAR T product, which again targets B-cell maturation antigen. So this was an oral session presented by Dr. Badeja from Nashville, and they presented the phase 1b study of 29 patients with a median age of 60 who had been treated with a median of 5 prior lines of therapy, some as high as 18, which is remarkable. And 76 were exposed to at least 5 classes, and 86% were triple class refractory, 31% pentaclass refractory. And the primary outcome was safety. So as is common with most CAR T cell delivery, the patients were initially given immunosuppression with cyclophosphamide and fludarabine over 3 days for lymphodepletion. And then the J&J 4528 product was delivered with a median dose of 0.73 times 10 to the 6 CAR T cells per kilogram as a single infusion. And the median follow-up was 9 months. And, you know, this is a number that is just so exciting, that the overall response rate was 100% in these patients, with a 86% stringent complete response and 96% very good partial response or better. And the median time to a complete response was only 2 months, which suggests that these are really biologically active cellular therapies. And the 6-month progression-free survival rate was 93%, with the longest response going on at about 15 months. Also impressively, 81% of the patients were negative for minimal residual disease, which is just quite amazing in this group of patients who were really highly refractory and probably did not have any other lines options that were this efficacious. Now, whether the duration of response is long-term remains to be determined, but at least the initial responses are quite impressive. In terms of the side effect profile, I think it was consistent with that of CAR T-cells, including cytokine release syndrome that was manageable, and cytopenias, including neutropenia and thrombocytopenia, was seen in most patients, though again, manageable in most patients. Of note, about 80% of patients did require bridging therapy. So again, CAR T-cell therapy is not necessarily off the shelf, but as the technology improves and it becomes more universally available, I think we'll be able to triage our patients on the trajectory to CAR T-cell therapy more readily when they're just beginning to perhaps relapse. So the phase 2 study has been fully enrolled, and this therapy has actually received breakthrough status designation by the FDA. And I think likely in this year, if not early 2021, we'll see our first approval for CAR T therapy for multiple myeloma.
What is your take-home message regarding cellular therapies in multiple myeloma, and how do you see these data impacting the space?
I think that cellular therapies, including autologous stem cell transplant and CAR T cell therapy, as well as bispecific antibodies, which we didn't talk about, but that also can activate T-cell immune therapy against multiple myeloma. I think these all have a very important role because they all are biologically based and harness the power of the patient's immune system to target multiple myeloma in the relapse refractory setting. I think they're incredibly important therapies that have their own, you know, logistical challenges to deliver, but that are not insurmountable. And I think, again, like with any therapy for multiple myeloma in the relapse refractory setting, I think as we bring them in earlier, there are ongoing studies, for example, in the first line, and there are planned studies comparing CAR T cell therapy to autologous stem cell transplant up front. You know, I think as those studies progress, I think we're going to be seeing an earlier inclusion of patients into CAR T cell therapy trials. And once we get an approval, we'll most likely send patients for CAR T therapy earlier on in their disease before they develop more clonal resistance. So I'm excited to see the response rates for these therapies. And I think as we become more adept at managing the toxicity profiles and synthesizing the CAR T cells from patients, which seems to be extremely feasible, I think more and more patients are going to be undergoing these therapies with better responses.
So we discussed a lot of data today. Is there anything else that you would like to add from the 2020 ASCO Virtual Scientific Program regarding multiple myeloma treatment that you think is important to mention and I didn't ask, or do you have an overall takeaway message for your colleagues?
No, I think it's a great time for multiple myeloma patients who now have so many different options, and why it's important to discuss those options with your patients. And I think that we're going to be seeing, you know, a lot more trials that are using combinations of these novel approaches for newly diagnosed and relapse refractory multiple myeloma patients. And I think it emphasizes why it's important to enroll multiple myeloma patients in clinical trials, because so many have been successful when using these novel agents that are really born out of a refined understanding of the pathophysiology of multiple myeloma that's been born out of such important and incredible work over the past two decades and beyond. So I think a clinical trial is always a reasonable option, whether it's for newly diagnosed or relapsed refractory patients. I think we're going to continue to see positive outcomes of these studies of combinations of novel agents. And I think we're well on our way to thinking about how we can actually cure this disease in the future as we work to overcome the resistance profiles of multiple myeloma.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives on cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.